This podcast is provided by New St. Andrews College. For more information, visit us online at nsa.edu or come see us here in Moscow, Idaho for one of our prospective student weekends, September 21st and 22nd and October 26th and 27th. For more information about the college or prospective student weekends, visit us online at nsa.edu.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming today. As Dr. Edwards mentioned, I'm the chair of the Alumni Association. My name's Dave Williams. I attended New St. Andrews from 01 to 05, so just finished up my 13th year out of college. As some of you may already know, today's Disputatio kicks off New St. Andrews' third annual Alumni Weekend. Over the next 3 days, the college's alum will have the opportunity to rest and relax and enjoy each other's fellowship, but most importantly, to temporarily pull ourselves out of the daily grind of our lives to recall and reflect upon the mission bestowed on us at graduation, which is to be instruments used to mold, shape, and ultimately change the culture around us. Today, as a way of kicking that off, I've asked Andrew Krapuschets to kick off Alumni Weekend by speaking to us about the impact that liberal arts grads have had on shaping the workplace over at EMSI. Currently, Andrew is the chief executive officer of EMSI. He joined the company as the third ever employee. He has led EMSI's transformation from a small consulting firm into an international and software data company. In 2018, he oversaw that's this year, he oversaw the sale of EMSI to the Strata Education Network, and is actively growing the company under that new leadership. Andrew has over 20 years of experience in the high-tech industry working with 3D modeling, data modeling, and software design. He speaks internationally on topics of the economy, business, higher education, workforce planning, and religion. He has also helped start several businesses, including Populi, Element Robot, Navigo, and a few others here in town. In addition to his work in business, Mr. Krapuschets has served as trustee of New St. Andrews College and currently serves on the board of Logos School, the Association of Classical Christian Schools, and Canon Press. Andrew and his wife Elise live in Idaho here with their 5 children. Please join me in welcoming him.
All right, no promises. I'm probably the least qualified speaker you've ever had. They thought I was retarded until I was 6. That's actually not a joke. Long story though, I'll tell you sometime. It's interesting. So, but I happen to hire a lot and employ a lot of NSA students and run an economics firm and do a bunch of stuff, and so you're stuck talking to me, or listening, as the case may be. So what I really want to talk about today is what is the role of a liberal arts education in today's labor market, right? How many of you have been told by friends and or relatives, why are you getting a Christian liberal arts education that won't lead to a great job? Yes. So I'm here, and I'm going to warn you, most of the people that told you that don't have any data. They just are jealous. I'm going to bring a bunch of data to the equation so that when those people bring it up, you're like, oh, that's kind of funny you say that. Let me answer that question right now. And you have all this rhetoric and reading and all these other things, so now I'm going to give you information to pack in that rhetoric. But before I do that, let me talk about what's going on in the economy today. Achievements in machine learning, deep learning, have sparked this almost wild concern that all of our jobs are going to go away to machines and computers, right? You've probably heard about it. It's actually called the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and there's a number of books that are being written on it or have been written on it right now. Fourth Industrial Revolution, and a lot of futurists believe that it will fundamentally change humans' interaction and position with machines. Machines are going to do a lot more things. The global payroll is $157 billion in wages every single year. The McKinsey Group believes that half of those jobs are going to be automated at some point. they don't give a timeline, because if you give a projection without a timeline, no one can prove you wrong ever. So the McKinsey Group does a lot of those kind of things. There are some futurists that believe anywhere between 9 and 47% of all jobs will not exist in the future, and everyone's pretty panicky about it. There are a number of YouTube things, you can look them up. Humans may not need not apply. It's really interesting about how the world is changing. The number of manufacturing jobs in America is down significantly, and the jobs that are still there are completely different than what they were 10 years ago. Right? So machines and computers are changing the way that we work and the fundamentally the way that we think. I think this fourth industrial revolution is a lot like the first three. And if a people 100 years ago panicked as much as we do today, and my argument is they didn't because they didn't have Twitter, and so they didn't panic as much because they didn't know all the bad things that were going to happen to them. But if they had panicked and they knew all those things, the farriers of 100 years ago would have been panicked about the automobile, right? No more horseshoeing jobs. Bummer. Although I've done it once. It is a really terrible job to shoe a horse. And obviously the automobile has some advantages to horses. There were parts of Chicago 100 years ago, they really struggled with the horse manure. They couldn't take it anywhere. There was so much of it. And now we just have smog. It's awesome. If you look at the jobs, some of the hottest jobs in America today, commercial truck drivers. There's 3.3 million of them in America. There's over 5 million job postings for commercial truck drivers today. And I would argue that in not too distant future, self-driving trucks will put all of them out of work. Right? Here's a couple other ones. Nursing assistants. There's 1.5 million nursing assistants. They're actually not nurses, they're just help. And it's not that there's going to be like a nursing assistant robot that's going to come around and do the job of a nursing assistant. It's going to be software that makes their life so much easier that the nurses don't need an assistant anymore, right? 1.5 million people today will not have that job in the future, right? So I'm trying to give you a little doom and gloom. It's what everybody's worried about. And while, you know, I'm talking about personal care aides, manufacturing, it's not a huge part of the economy. But if you're part of that economy, it is a huge part for you, right? And so why does this matter to you as NSA students? Think about it this way. If you have a job and you can easily write down all the tasks that you accomplish, a machine can do it, right? If you have a job and you can define very easily and succinctly what you can accomplish, that's what computers are good at, right? So what's your education preparing you for? Hopefully more than just a whole list of tasks, right? And that's what I would argue, that you are preparing yourself for what the economy is going to be. And when these people tell you why you're getting a useless education at NSA, think about it this way. There are a lot of businesses today, it's not just in these hallowed halls that, and hallowed they are. It's not just in NSA that liberal arts and classical education is being valued. We work with a lot of employers. We had the head of people analytics for Facebook in town last week. And liberal arts and the ability for people to really understand how to solve problems and how to lead, how to communicate, is the top skill set that CEOs are looking for today, which is interesting and obviously applicable to you. Workers will need to be flexible and agile, able to shift and grow over the course of their careers. And it's increasingly clear that it's not easy to automate things like creative thinking, critical thinking, emotional intelligence, and communication. Well, guess what? Those are the top things being asked for by employers in America today, right? Now, if you're going to go build a bridge, right? If you're going to be that, I would encourage you to get an engineering degree, because I don't want to drive over a bridge that any of you have built. Nothing personal, right? So you need to have specific skills in some areas. But the workforce of the future, I would argue, is going to be the workforce that understands how to think and how to learn. So here's some more data and some more analysis. So MZ, we're over there, Economic Modeling Specialist International. MZ is easier to say. Headquarters here, we have an office in Dallas and outside of London, and about 160 employees. So we have scraped the internet for over 100 million profiles of workers in America, and we have over 1 billion profiles of workers globally. So, and once you scrape that, you start to see interesting things come out of it, right? You can start to see what was their first job after college, what was their next job, what skills do they talk about in their resume, et cetera. So with that information, we have analyzed where do liberal arts show up in the labor market, right? So the most likely job for liberal arts to start with is sales. Makes sense, right? And here's my big caveat. We're looking at liberal arts generally, not an NSA education. I would argue that you are getting a far better education, and I think Dr. Edwards would agree with me, a far better education than the standard philosophy or psychology degree, which also fall in that kind of liberal arts category. But there aren't enough of you to do significant statistical analysis on, so we're stuck with liberal arts. So liberal arts, the most likely job that they're going to start with is a sales job where they're communicating, right? Well, sales in America is actually a job where you can, especially software sales, you can earn six figures very quickly, right? So that's not a dead-end job. But it's also interesting, the first job is not necessarily a barista or a teacher. It's actually a professional job. Well, guess what the next most likely job for a liberal arts person to be in of the millions of people we analyzed? Management. Second job, which is fascinating, right? And you are 70% more likely to have management be your second job than someone without a liberal arts degree. Let that sink in. I could be something. It's exciting, right? But it's true. So management is the top most likely. If I go down the list of other significant degrees or careers that liberal arts people go to, you have marketing and advertising, sales, business and financial analysts, management, journalism, business administration, public relations. Well, what are those jobs? What do those jobs do? Well, obviously, in one sense, they are driving value for the business that you're working for, right? You're managing people, you're getting word out about what you're trying to accomplish for that business. But what are they doing, right? What is journalism doing? What is management doing? What is public relations doing? You are presenting that business, and you're telling people what to think, right? As a manager, you get to tell employees, what should you think about? What should you be doing? As journalists, as writers, you are shaping culture. Have you heard that before? Right? So the next time a relative tells you you're getting a useless degree, agree with them, and then you'll be managing their children later. just let that settle in. The only reason I bring that up is because I manage a lot of people who did far better in college than I did, given that I actually never went to college. MZ's in the process of doing this research, and obviously it's very applicable to you, but it's really interesting that the common thinking that people have had about liberal arts is not true. While you can't build a bridge right after you graduate, you are on a track to be a leader and shaper of culture in the workplace, right? Which is exactly what you want to be doing. Okay, so now you know why you should do this, and you are being given the education of a free man, right? This is a liberal arts education. You can think about things, you can drive things. And these are talents that have been landed on you, right? We talk about the parable with the talents. You now have a whole list of talents. So what are you going to do with them? And here's my challenge to you. Be really ambitious, right? Don't bury these talents in the ground. And first of all, again, I want to inspire you that you are being given talents that will allow you to be a leader and shaper of culture. Now, be ambitious with them, right? Don't just sit on them. Don't just go off and do a dead-end job. Go be a manager, start a business, and drive things, right? Great jobs come to those who work their tail off, regardless of what education they get, but I think you're being prepared for a great job and a leadership position in a way that many others don't. I would also encourage you to don't narrowly define your career choices based on this, right? There are a lot of you that will probably be teachers, and that's phenomenal, right? We need teachers, we need people who can shape the next culture, but don't necessarily box yourself into that. Remember the most common job for liberal arts people, their second job is management, right? You should be able to lead people because of the gifts that you've been given. Don't get stuck in nice, tight categories. The other thing that I've encouraged you to do, and I've encouraged other people to do this, is shape culture in such a way that really has an impact, right? And I've challenged others, think about it this way. How many of you think you're going to give away $1 million someday? Not make, but give away $1 million someday. You can raise your hand. It's all right. It's fun, right? No, but really, if you're given these tools and you use them to the glory of God, there's no reason you shouldn't go out into culture and take it by storm, make a pile of money, give it away, build a church, build a school, give it back to NSA, right? We've got folks, yeah, right? Yep. I get a commission on that. But really, there's no reason that you can't do that, and I would encourage you, don't box yourself in with this education. There's no reason you shouldn't be earning a heavy six-figure salary, taking care of your family, taking extravagant vacations, building churches, and taking the culture by storm, right? You're given this phenomenal education. Don't go halfway. Really be ambitious about it. And this is what God has given you, so don't bury it in the ground. And also remember that success comes in lots of different flavors, right? We all know this. We would all rather you have a great marriage and a great family than earn tons of money. But if you can do both, it's okay, right? So the research shows that there's no reason you shouldn't take the culture by storm. And so be ambitious and do it, right? Okay, a little bit more about MZ, and then I will hand it over, or we'll have a discussion or something of that nature. MZ has 160 employees, 41 of them are NSA grads. So a fourth of we are the top employer of NSA grads. Not a bad thing. If you look, and so then I did this interesting analysis. Remember I talked about these 100 million resumes that are out there that we have. So I did some analysis on what are all the other NSA grads doing out in the world. And so the problem is it's based on resumes that are on the internet, and so it's going to have a bias. But of all the other people that are out there that aren't working at MZ, the top job category today is general and operations manager, which in the U.S. makes about $100,000 a year, right? So again, there's another statistic that you can throw at your relatives that, no, I won't be necessarily a great accountant or engineer, but I will lead and shape culture. And I might just make a bunch of money in the meantime. So that's true. Our CFO, Timothy Vandenbroek, is an NSA alum. Luke Jankovic, one of our executive vice presidents, is an NSA alum. And lots of other very productive people earning lots of money, having a great job, and taking care of their family. So, and while the ramp-up time is a little bit longer for NSA grads, because many of you haven't learned computer programming or haven't learned accounting or economics in the way that might be helpful at MZ, you are absolutely prepared for the workforce. One of our top data scientists, Dave Beecham, came to MZ and from NSA directly without programming knowledge, and because of his education in music and his logical thinking that he learned at NSA, he is a highly sought after commodity all over the world, but he stays at MZ anyway. So. Big recap, you are being given skills that the economy wants, right? Remember that. You're being given skills the economy wants, and it is the right thing for you to be following these things. Be ambitious with the talents that God's given you and the skills that God's given you. Don't go halfway, right? Engage culture, do things. And if you're really smart, you should come work at MZ. Thank you.
So you didn't have the NSA education?
No.
you're CEO of MZ, a successful company. And was it in the way you got there, the skills you had to pick up, whether it's communication, management, how did for you, just in terms of your story,
yeah,
how did that work out? How did that happen?
Yeah, okay. So not only do I not have an NSA education, I don't have any education, yeah. My wife is kind of Dr. Crappuschatz, and I'm kind of sub-GED Crappuschatz. We make a good team. I paid off her student debt, though, so I feel like I did my part. when I was in the Bay Area, where I grew up, I really wanted to work because I like to earn money, and because it is good, it keeps you away from sin to work a lot, actually, as a young man. It's a really helpful thing. So at 16, I got a job as a shipping and receiving guy at a .com in the Bay Area. And my rule of life was always find the worst job that nobody else wants to do and do it with all my might as unto the Lord, right? I've told other people that I call it the porta potty guy concept. Raise your hand if you've always wanted to be a porta potty person. No, nobody wants to run that business. Do you think that person makes a ton of money? Yes, because nobody else wants to run that business, right? There's this supply-demand curve, and people need porta-potties, but nobody wants to do it. So you make a lot of money. You can charge anything you want. So if you want to be, it's true. So my rule of life was, how do I throw myself into the worst jobs that nobody else wants to do with all my might, right? And lo and behold, responsibility follows those who are willing to take responsibility, or authority follows those who want to take responsibility. So within a year, I was running the shipping department, and by the time I was 18, I was traveling all over the world teaching software, and then I got burned out at the ripe age of 22. I moved up to Moscow. The .com I was working for, we had $32 million of venture capital money, which was fun. I played nice rounds of golf in Japan. I turned 21 on an expense account, which is cool. Really nice bottles of wine. And then I moved up here. They went out of business, because that's what happens when you do that stuff. And so I looked around town, and I said, there's no great jobs, right? And again, this is back to, there's no reason you can't take responsibility like this. It's like, well, if anyone's going to create jobs, why not me? And so our original goal when we started MZ was 50 people earning over $50,000 a year in Moscow. Right? $2.5 million payroll, we felt that would move the needle on the town. And as a secondary goal, one of my favorite things to do in the world is eat, as you can tell from a distance. And I figured if I had a lot of high-paying jobs, there would be lots of restaurants and food in town, and I think it's working, right? There's some pretty good food in town. So I would just say that it's all about taking responsibility, working your tail off, and I didn't have the tools that you guys have, right? So you should go much farther and faster than I did.
So there's hard work, and there's the willingness to do things that other people won't do, which is a basic Christian.
Yes.
But humility plays a part in that.
Right. And if you can read Calvin's Institute in like 2 days or whatever you guys do, you should be able to do anything. Right? No, but that's it. Like, if you're willing to work hard, if you're willing to take responsibility, if you're, and you find that second gear in life, right? When it's 2 a.m. and you're not done reading that book, you have a choice, right? You can go to sleep, or you can finish it. I can't tell you how many times in business you have that exact same thing. It's 2 a.m. I can either figure this out and be successful in business, or I can just go to sleep. And maybe I fail, right? And you're being prepared to make that the right decision because you've been sleep deprived for 4 years, and so you're good at it.
We talk about shaping culture. And the data about management, obviously, to shape culture, authority is helpful.
Yeah.
To get to management, sometimes faithfulness is tested, and the ability to shape culture is less. So can you talk about a little bit about the challenge of, you know, Christian entering into the workplace, wanting to shape culture, but you're under the culture to a degree of that workplace that you're in.
Right. Well, I'd say there's always a bigger fish, right? There's always someone bigger that can always fire you. So even if you're the boss of MZ, I always have a boss, right? And so you're always going to have to agree that you're going to stand for your faith. And so I know many businessmen in the Bay Area or in Texas where I grew up who finish their career at 65. And I remember having this conversation with a very successful billionaire. And he says, well, I'm now done with my career. Now I want to do something for Christ. I'm like, well, what have you been doing the whole time? Right? And he's like, well, I've just been negotiating and, you know, beating people up and winning lots of money. And it's like, well, what if, like, business needs to be saved just like anything else, right? Politics needs to be saved. It's not a savior. Well, business needs to be saved. And there's a lot of businessmen out there that are not deeply applying the Bible to the way that you do this. When we had Career Builders, our owner, which is not anymore, I had to rewrite our employee manual. And so I challenged my people, how do you deeply embed biblical principles, even though I know that they'll nix it if I use the Bible verse that it's connected to, right? But there's no reason you can't do that. The other thing I'd encourage you to do is when you go out in the culture, and I know this is going to sound far-fetched, but look at Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a little bit crazy, but he just does whatever he wants. And a lot of people respect that, right? And I can't tell you, I told, 5 years ago, I told an HR person in Chicago, they were concerned about me praying at a meeting. And I told her that my dream in life was to be sued for the gospel. She didn't like that at all. But there was a lot of respect that, like, I'm not afraid of what I actually believe, right? And so you would be surprised how much people are desperate for people who know what they believe and will say it, right? And will say it in a way that's not trying to just poke them in the eye, and say it in a way where they're working hard and doing the right thing. But the world is desperate for leaders who know what they believe and will say it and will live it out and will apply the Bible to every aspect of their life. And I've had homosexual HR people that have been here to our Moscow office and said, you know, I don't agree with most of what you're doing. You know, we talk about it at our company. We talk about bless the customer. We want our customers to be better people because they interact with us. Talk about bless the employee because we want people to be better people because they work at MZ. We pray at meals. Whenever it's my meal, I pray at it. If I'm paying for it, it's my meal, and we're blessing it. And these people struggle with what we're doing, but man, they love that we actually know what we believe, and we say it, and we do it, and we live it out, and we're not hypocrites and like, well, we're going to do it in some situations. No, if God is God, he's God of this, right? And you'd be surprised how much people really respect that.
Good. I'm going to open it up for questions from the floor before, otherwise I'll just keep talking to Bobby. And we've got the roving microphone.
Faster.
When your boss says faster.
So at the start of the talk, you were talking a lot about how liberal arts jobs, despite what your relatives might say, tend to make a lot of money, actually. Last year, Isaac Waitman gave a talk on how liberal arts degrees, yeah, they might be successful, but it's not about making money. And if you are the poorest person in town, you could still be a success. So, and this seems somewhat like a fairly obvious question, but what is the relationship between those two statements? Why are we looking for, or what should we think about jobs that offer a lot of money? What, yeah.
Yep, Isaac Waitman's wrong. No, I'm kidding. No, obviously, as I said, success is defined in lots of different ways, right? You're not simply, money is a tool, it is not the master, and when it becomes your master, it is a wicked master, right? And we know that. But it is a very powerful tool to shape culture, right? You can buy things. I bought the biggest billboard in town, the silos. you can start businesses, you can employ people, you can build churches and schools, you can do things with money. And so while money should not be the goal, there's nothing wrong with pursuing it in a godly way, I would say, right? I met a man in Minneapolis who had just made $350 million and I'd never seen anyone so sad in my life because his kids hated him and his wife hated him, right? And that's when money is the master, and money is a wicked, wicked master. But if you can use money to glorify God, he has given it the cattle on 1,000 hills is God, so he's rich. And and it's okay to imitate God as long as we are doing it in a godly way, I would argue.
And there are many examples of people who have done that. And there are many examples of people like C.T. Studd got converted, gave up an international sports career, gave all his money away. You know, there's no one way either or the other, but there are lots of people out there who you've never heard of who are bankrolling missions, yeah, church building, education, and it's a wonderful gift. Other questions? Allison.
So you mentioned that one of your goals, your company goals, is to bless the the employee. Did that play a role in the way that you designed your building, or how you shaped your office space?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. It probably did. I mean, we talk about blessing our customers. So we have three principles, and we do them in this order. You always bless your customers first. Customer's king, right? And then we bless employees. And I will tell you, there have been 5 people that have come to the Lord because they worked at MC, right? And praise the Lord. We bless our employees, and it's not because we beat them over the head with, John 3:16. It's because when you live it out in your life, people notice, and this is how you shape culture. It's one of the ways you shape culture, right? And then if we bless the customer first, then the employees, then the shareholders will be blessed, right? We still have shareholders, and they shouldn't be forgotten in the equation. And so they are blessed as part of this, right? As far as our building, with the building, it was just all the things I would want, I try and give to other people, right? So like at MZ, if I want a clean car, I bet everybody wants a clean car. So my son comes and cleans everybody's car. Because, right? Why not? I would like a bonus check. I bet everybody would like a bonus check. I would like a beer right now. I bet. So when we were designing the building, it was like, okay, would I want to work in each of these spots, right? And it's how do I give everyone what I would want in return? So I think that was part of it. I wanted a lawn on the roof, so we have a lawn on the roof. I think that was about it. You'd be surprised how little thought we put into some things.
We've got lots of hands. I think Isaiah at the back, Isaiah, as they say in this part of the world.
Yes. So you were talking before about staying up until 2 a.m. and you have the decision, you can figure it out or you cannot figure it out. Obviously, there's a line somewhere between like being a slave to your career and that's, staying up until 2 a.m. when you should be getting enough sleep that you can be like kind to your wife the next day.
Yep.
So how do you determine the line between like being the person who stays up till 2 a.m. to figure it out and not being a slave to it?
Well, it's a good question. I'd say part of it's a pattern, right? Is that your lifestyle? Or is that an occasion that you need to find that second gear and figure it out, right? And if it is your lifestyle, that's wrong, I would argue. I have a lot of rules that I try and follow to make sure that I don't, because I am ambitious and I want to, I would like to hire another 150 people here in town, and I would like another 10 restaurants in town, and I would like a huge MZ tower that I have a trebuchet on top that I can throw Buicks. These are all things that I want, but I'm not going to get them all, probably. But I have a rule that I try and travel no more than 3 nights a month, because having kids that know me and love God is more important than any of those things, right? And so I think I find it really helpful to build systematic ways. The same thing with giving money, where we try and give as much as we can. We try and give 30% away off the top, and we try and put it in, and we just do it systematically. It's a lot easier. And if you find that you are staying up till 2 a.m. all the time, then something's wrong, right? And so that's, but there's always that time when you need to solve this problem. And it's the same thing when you need to solve that problem at your household or your wife, you need to stay up till 2 a.m. talking about stuff and you need to stay awake. So it's just an important rule that problems don't always happen from 9 to 5.
They usually start about 5:15.
5:15, yeah.
That's where they begin. There were a few hands down here originally. Maria.
What advice would you give to people who aren't sure what they want to do vocationally after college?
Just go do stuff, right? Part of it is don't stress too much. Just do the work that's right in front of you. I give the example of there's a book called Thinking Fast and Slow. I thought it was fascinating. Whole series of experiments on Stanford students primarily. And what happens, like one of the experiments, they had a bunch of these students who, they gave them a bunch of letters that easily made words that sounded like slow and fast and old and decrepit, right? And they told them, you have an hour to try and build as many words with these as you can, right? Then they had another group of students, they gave them letters that easily turned into fast and young and spry and all these kind of things, right? But the real experiment was after they'd spent an hour really focusing on these words, they had a 100-foot hallway that they had them walk down. And the first group of students walked 20% slower. I think that's so weird that you would do that. Anyway, but one of the experiments in this book is they took a whole bunch of students and they said, okay, your group of students, make as many clay pots as you can in one day. And they went to this other group of students and they said, make one clay pot, use the golden proportions, do everything just right on that clay pot. Then they lined them all up. The first group made 40. The next group made one, obviously. They lined them all up randomly and had judges come in and judge them. The group that did the one pot got 7th place. Right? Because when you just do work, you learn a lot about what you love and what's in front of you. So just go out and do stuff, right? Bless people. Go find someone who needs their house cleaned and find out you don't like cleaning houses, right? But go do stuff. Right? So that's what I would recommend.
Hannah.
Following up on that, what are your thoughts on the principle of do what you love? At what point do you go and say, hey, I like reading books, so I'm going to do that in my free time, and the rest of my time I'm going to get a job and, you know, work with Excel spreadsheets all day and make money? Like, where is the line for that?
Yeah. Well, so part of it is, remember that you need to mortify what you love sometimes, right, in one sense. Remember, you have a sinful heart. We all have sinful hearts. And so if you love to play video games, right, we know that that's just not the best use of the rest of your life. And so you need to be aware that just because you want it doesn't mean it's necessarily righteous. Now, that being said, I like to think of it in a Venn diagram. I'm going to go a little philosophical here. So Venn diagram, so you've got a bubble of these are all the things you like to do, and here's another bubble down here of all the things people will pay you to do, right? And ideally you find out where those overlap, right? And then if you need training to get there, then you can, you know, think of a third bubble. But really think of those two as you want to try and find things that you love to do that people will pay you to do. I always wanted to play professional baseball, but it turns out I'm not good enough. And so no one would pay me to do it. So here I am.
I thought you could do anything you wanted to in this country, if you wanted it hard enough.
Nope.
No.
Nope.
I moved here.
Yes.
You just crushed all my dreams.
And the deal is, some dreams need to die.
Yeah. John, here in the middle. Yeah.
So, having talked to a bunch of relatives and actually students here at NSA, some people think that there's an inconsistency with NSA's mission to shape culture and the fact that a lot of NSA students stick around in Moscow after graduating. How would you interact with that sentiment?
That's a pretty good question. So there's a lot of different ways to shape culture, right? There's ways to shape culture by going somewhere and having a job and doing things. There's ways to shape culture by movies and writing and leading in that way. I would also say that there's a lot of culture shaping that still needs to happen in Moscow, right? We had a gay pride parade in downtown Moscow a couple weeks ago. Like, there's still work to be done here. And so I'd say once we've completely taken dominion of our culture here, then you can leave. So. I guess I could give more of an answer, but no, I mean, I just think there's an enormous amount of work to be done here as well as other places. There's nothing wrong with ganging up on one city and trying to completely take over the culture, right? And then we can move on to other cities. And I'd say, well, there's still a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of work to be done here. There's a lot of work to be done other places. And so you want to go where you can have the greatest impact on the gospel and shaping culture, right? And sometimes, you know, if you're in a canoe and everybody rows at different times, you don't go as fast as if everybody's rowing at the same time, right? And so, okay, well, what if we all put our backs into changing this town, changing the University of Idaho, changing Wazoo, right? And then we'll work from there. So just tell them there's still a lot of work to be done here. You should come to Moscow. It's terrible.
Jonathan was wanting a question. Still want that question, Jonathan? Good. Okay.
Faster.
I'm a terrible person. So I was wondering, usually out of college you have some low non-management positions. So how would you start shaping culture when you're doing more of the grunt work, like, for instance, fixing computers?
sorry, I was going to make some snide. So let's look at some biblical examples of people who just did stuff, right? Look at Joseph. What was his job? Well, he just started working on stuff. Goes to Egypt, gets put in prison, and then suddenly he's managing the prison because God was with him and he was wise, right? You look at the way that God blesses those things. I'll tell you, I started at EMSI as a printer repair guy. No, but really, I did. I was working at the, my .com goes out of business, and I'm like, I don't know what I should do. I played a little bit of golf, but I thought I should earn some money. So I get a job at the U of I building multimedia curriculum, super boring. And Shel Christofferson, but then in my free time, I did all the IT work for all the nonprofits in town that I could find, Christ Church being one of them. And Shel calls the Christ Church and says, hey, my printer won't work. Do you know anybody who can fix it? Like, well, there's this guy that comes by and fixes everything. And so Shell calls me out of the blue on my cell phone and says, I can't print, can you fix it? I said, sure, who are you? And so I went and fixed his printer, and then he let me stick around, and now I run the company. So you're gunning for me.
Mr. Bill Church at the back, you have to run really fast.
You can yell from there, come on, I've heard you.
Andrew, I know you've been involved in a lot of entrepreneurial things. Can you speak to the liberal arts degree and entrepreneurship, or the gig economy, that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is kind of what I was talking about a little bit, right? If you get a degree in mechanical engineering, which is fine, it's a totally lawful thing to do, but if you do that, it's definitely putting you in a box, right? You're a mechanical engineer, and if you go off and decide to do something else, you're kind of wasting this 4 years of education, right? And there's some things that transfer, but for the most part, right, entrepreneurship is all about finding problems that customers have and solving them in a very creative way, in a way that makes money, right? And so I would say that liberal arts are better equipped for that. Also, so people always had very low expectations for me as a person. So my mom prayed, no, it was really, my mom prayed every day that I'd be able to support a family for years, and it worked. I have a family. And so, but part of it is when someone has very high expectation, you're a mechanical engineer, you're going to go create that trabuchet that we can throw Buicks with. It's going to be awesome, right? You need a mechanical engineer for that. But the deal is, if you're a liberal arts person, you have this world open to you. You have this creative opportunity, and you're not boxed in the same way. And so I think it actually prepares you better to start a business because you don't have these high expectations of you're going to be a mechanical engineer and earn a certain amount of money, yada, yada, yada. They don't know what you're going to do, and then you get to decide. So I don't know if that was a good answer, but there it is.
Can you just talk a moment about how failure plays into success?
Yeah. Malcolm Gladwell talks about, so I'm dyslexic, the other thing, and I'm sorry I'm talking about myself so much, but I think I'm fascinating. Malcolm Gladwell talks about dyslexia, because I'm wildly dyslexic. Like, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm an 8, which means I try not to read in public unless I absolutely have to, because I'm really bad at it. But he did this study on a bunch of kids who were dyslexics, and they kind of talk about, like, the reason people actually thought that I had learning disabilities when I was 6 and I was kicked out of kindergarten, believe it or not. So I was homeschooled for a while because the Christian school wouldn't have me. And so he talks about all these dyslexic kids, and all these dyslexic kids come to kindergarten or first grade or second grade. That's usually about the point that they realize it, and they go, oh, shoot, I'm bad at literally everything they care about. I'm bad at numbers and letters and reading. Like, those are the only things, and I'm bad at all of them. So they have one of two responses. They can either just go, oh, well, and be a loser, or they look around the classroom and be like, Johnny over there looks pretty smart. I'm going to need him to do most of my homework because I can't, and so he's going to need, somebody has to. And it's true. And there was this one Disney executive who was wildly dyslexic, and he said by the time he was in sixth grade, he could talk his way up one grade. So as long as he could get a D, he could get himself to a C. And by the time he was in high school, he could talk his way up two grades, right? So if you could get yourself a D, all of a sudden you're at a B, and life's not that bad, right? Well, the funny part is that all of these failures are unbelievable training for negotiation and delegation, right? You've been delegating to Johnny for years. What if you start paying him? Now, I'm not going to recommend any of these tactics. But it's true. So
you've just given a whole lot of freshmen sort of ideas.
So if you can delegate and you can negotiate, you don't actually have to do schoolwork. So, but like those, the dyslexic people basically live their life as failures for a very long time. They get so used to it, right? I was telling somebody else that, so everyone told me I was dumb until I was, well, just until last week. But everyone when you're told that all the time and you're in a negotiation, you can say something dumb because what's the worst thing they say to you? That was dumb. Like, heard that before, right? So fail a couple times and then it's not that bad, right? So I failed at a lot of things. Dr. Erb, I took piano lessons for a year and I practiced diligently, and the piano teacher told me, you really should be doing something else with your time. And I was paying the guy. So you just fail at things and then it's okay and you just get used to it. So, and then the other thing that I would say around failure is we as Christians should be able to fail better than anybody else, right? We know that God is sovereign and God loves us. And let's say you fail at business or you fail at school or you fail at baseball or you fail at all kinds of things, right? You still have Christ, right? And what's more important than that? So we should be able to fail and take a risk. We should have a higher risk tolerance than non-Christians because we know what the point of what we're doing is, right? And so that's where be ambitious, go out and fail, and you're going to learn tons by it. And it also inoculates you, you know what I mean, from worrying about failure, right? If you go out, I actually had this friend, he was struggling in a sales job. He's like, I just struggle with people saying no. So I had this idea for him. I said, why don't you go and ask an extravagant question of a random stranger every day for 100 days in a row? So he would go up to strangers on the street and say, may I have $100? And they'd be like, no. He'd be like, oh, okay, well, it's worth asking, right? So he did that, but that's it. He did that for 100 days, and three times someone said, sure. And he got $300. Just go out and do stuff. And sometimes it works out, most of the time it won't. But then he was pretty okay with a no from then on.
I'm just thinking of all the issues I'm going to have to deal with next week.
Worst speaker ever.
Yeah, do you remember what that Andrew Krapachet said? Well, it's not that. Any more? There's some more hands I saw, I'm sure. Bobby, again.
You can ask any question. How often I shave my head, how much I weigh, anything.
We don't want to know how much you weigh, Andrew.
205 pounds.
I was thinking about asking for an SCL in Hebrew, but I was going to ask, you mentioned earlier that the top NSA job outside of MZ is some sort of management job. I forget what it is exactly.
Yeah, management operations or something like that. Yeah.
Do you happen to know what the second job is, just out of curiosity?
Loser. No, I don't. I'll tell you. No, I actually don't know. I didn't put it in my notes. Nope, I have no idea. Part of it is probably teacher, right? A lot of you are going to go on to be teachers, and many of you are not going to have an online profile that advertises that. Therefore, again, the data that I said, it has a bias towards people who have an online career presence. Therefore, it's going to have a bias towards the higher end. No, many of you are going to be teachers, right? But that is shaping culture in a very, very important way. If you have kids who love the Lord and understand the subject, that's a great blessing. But I don't know what number two is.
Victoria, third time lucky.
Yeah. Sorry, Luke.
Problem solving.
I know.
That was impressive.
Luke's a clever boy.
I was just wondering if you had a like a gender demographic for NSA grads, because it seems like, you know, the kind of classic thing everybody says, you know, all the girls come here just to get married, and it seems like that would kind of be the second job on the list.
Right. Worst NSA interview ever. I had a dude come in my office, and he says, hey, can I have a job? I said, what do you want to do? He says, I don't know. I just need a job so I can get married. I said, get out of my office. What's the demographic? NSA students who are male, female. It's a mix, but I don't know off the top of my head. I'm sure it's more heavily weighted towards males. It just is. But there are plenty who have graduated from NSA. Kelsey Behrens runs our HR department and is an NSA grad and is doing a phenomenal job. And there are many others.
Down at the front here, Eric.
So I was just curious about, do you think there's a possibility of synthesizing higher culture, higher arts like architecture or painting or sculpture with business, economic culture kind of?
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's you need business, you need money to buy paintings. I have two paintings in my house by a guy who was the court painter for William of Orange. And so he was basically a graphic designer on salary, and he just cranked out oil on canvas paintings all day long for good old William. And obviously it was important enough to have that guy on salary making beautiful things. Also, one of my wife and I's goals is how do we make Moscow a more beautiful place, right? And architecture is a huge part of that, but art and literature, all of those are outflows of a prospering economy where people are, you know, in the same way that restaurants come from great jobs and people doing stuff, you're going to see art and culture, and that's what it, you know, back to Moscow still has a lot of work to be done, and we need to shape a lot more culture here. There's still work to be done, so I think they're hand in hand. They're not separate. You look at any prospering economy, which is generally connected to prospering churches or historically Christian cultures, and you're going to see art and culture and architecture hand in hand with a prospering economy, and they go together. So
we've got time for one more. Danny, we'll go with two then, because praise is up once at the back. So Danny, and then praise.
Hey, what's up?
Not much, man.
Well, this is an oddly specific question, but you kept bringing it up in your talk. Will the restaurant industry be automized, or like, will there be like robot chefs making the food?
You've seen Star Trek. It's gonna be no. So yes, in one sense, right? I don't know that there's going to be robots making food, but if you look at the amount of employees per revenue in the restaurant industry in America, it has gone down significantly, right? Part of that is there is just more automation. There's more, and it's not necessarily that a specific job. Remember I talked about those, the nursing assistant. There's not a robot going around being a nursing assistant. There's just more efficiency for nurses such that they don't need as many assistants, right? And so servers and chefs and everything else, they bring automation, so all of a sudden you need one less person and one less person. So yeah, I think there will be, but I hope there's always people involved with food. There always will be, I think.
Praise.
So you talked about how you have a goal of being sued for praying in a board meeting.
Yeah.
I could name a lot of cultures where they don't tolerate such a thing. And so should we as Christians be open to such brutal effects of that? Or should we just start with a board meeting?
Yeah, I mean, I would. This is my opinion, but I think you need to be strategic and understand where you are in culture. And obviously you need to start where you are, not where you should be as a culture. I don't, you know, I talked about some of the people who have come to the Lord because of their time at EMSI. I don't go around sharing the gospel with new employees. I just live it out in my life, right? And while I have prayed at board meetings, I don't force the issue. We have a users conference. We had 200 people come to Coeur d'Alene last week. And I didn't pray for the opening of that because I would be praying at them, not with them, right? If we're having a meal that I'm paying for, well, then it's my meal and I'm blessing the meal, right? And so the question is, what are you trying to accomplish with that? And you want to be winsome in the way that you share the gospel and the way that you live out the gospel. And so I don't think the point is to just do things so you get in trouble. I was mostly saying that to the HR person to make them really upset. But at the same time, we do not need to not be afraid of the gospel. We do need to be people who know what we believe and not, aren't afraid of it. Right? And yes, there are consequences for that. I've had multiple employees. Whenever I hire someone, I always let them know, EMSI is a Christian company in the way that we run it, and that's not a prerequisite for you to work here, and it's not a super weird thing, but you need to know what you're getting into. And I've had multiple really good employees say, then I'm out, I'm not interested. And so there are consequences sometimes, but And so I would say, right, it's a balancing act where you want to be winsome in how you are living out the gospel, but not afraid. And so every situation is different, right? So, yeah, you just need to read your audience well, and but don't be afraid.
And the reality is, in the culture we are part of now, you go into any job, there has to be in the back of your mind, I need to be willing to be sacked.
Correct. Yep.
That has to be just, that's a reality now.
Yes, yeah. No, that HR person was very offended by the fact that I said that. But in the context of that conversation, it made a lot of sense because she wanted me to dial down the way that I talked about blessing customers and employees. And so I thought, instead of dialing it down, I'm going to talk about dialing it up. And then she'll be happy with what I was doing before.
Andrew, thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, sure. Thanks.
Stand for the doxology. Dr. Erb will lead us.
I'm a 2009 graduate of New St. Andrews College, and I'm a commercial property manager.
Three kids at Logos, one at home still, and I do flowers on the side out of our house. When you have these little people that you're responsible to shepherd, you realize I need to know what I'm talking about because they need to have a firm foundation and they need deep roots so that they don't get blown over and that they're ready to stand up for the truth.
I am a programmer. The language aspect of NSA is a fantastic preparation for any sort of programming.
I'm a real estate broker here in town. I think absolutely the perfect education for being in sales of really any kind.
I actually put it to a lot of great use when I was working in the political realm.
I am a pastor in Central Coast, California. Whatever vocation you take, it'll make you take that seriously because you're seeing it through the lens of the sovereignty and lordship of Christ.
For more information, visit us online at nsa.edu.